accession number 18719, reel 2.
Of course, this was very cock-a-loop to us internees. There was an occasion on November, Armistice Day, 11th November 1944, when we saw in the way up in the blue-blue autumn skies of China, not a cloud, just a blue-blue sky, and there was five little silver fish. And these were American planes which had come off an aircraft carrier on the Pacific, and they had a reconnoitering tour over the part of Kiangsu or the Shanghai area. The Japanese in the air camp just went mad. They waved swords as if that was going to do anything, because these people who seemed to be knowledgeable said that these planes were at least 20,000 feet up. Some of the officer boys drew their revolvers. One very excitable chap called Dogface by us, he had a couple of shots fired off a revolver. Well, you know, revolvers only, 100 yards, 50 feet, and there it was. So we had a very good laugh at that. And then we had some secret information in the camp. There was one man had rigged up bits and pieces and could receive the Delhi, which was the BBC from India, and we got quite a bit of news every night. And the Japanese, some informer and the Japanese told the Japanese, but they searched the camp and never found this receiving set. It was only a small thing, I was told, and I don't know where it was located or how it was hidden, but I believe the news from India came through at 2 o'clock in the morning. That's all I know, and I must say the information was very welcome, and we couldn't complain about despondency, because as the time went on we realized we were on the winning side, and it was only a question of time as long as we could hold out. Disciplined by the Japanese gendarmerie. These tough boys wore long pigskin boots up to the knees, down on the heel, carried a sword, and also armed with a revolver. They were to be played with. And they each morning took roll call to see that none of us had escaped over the night or during the day. 9 o'clock, all the camp lined up in groups according to their rooms and numbers, and the captain or spokesman had to speak parrot fashion in Japanese, room number so-and-so, so many men all present, and then each group had to number from the right. And these fellas were watching, the gendarmes watched us in the front and in the rear. Nobody was sort of stepping in to replace somebody missing. The numbering was very amusing. For instance, I was in room 5 and we had 31 members, the largest complement in the camp. And I can remember now being told to number. And then it starts at Ichi, Ni, San, Yon, Go, Roko. I was Roko, number 6, and so on. At the end of the numbering, everything was all right. Our camp commandant, a very good sort, Harold Collar, and his assistant, Bill Wright, would ask us to turn and face east and bow. This was the orders of the gendarmes, and we were bowing to the emperor. And we all muttered, "Bako." Bako is the only swear word in Japanese, and it means fool. And I can assure you, if you say "Bako" to a Japanese, it has a very electric effect. He jumps sky high if he's a gendarme, but take care he doesn't see you, and who shouted "Bako." Then is we had ample time with about 280 of us and only five elderly people who couldn't do anything. So we had a lot of leisure and we each had little jobs, maybe took half an hour or an hour. So quite a few classes were started. For instance, there was a Japanese class. Some of our members of the Shanghai Municipal Police were fluent Japanese speakers. Then we had a Spanish crowd, and there was Chinese, and there was a Portuguese little class. I attended the Chinese class, and it was quite good after a while. I got out the Shanghai dialect, and I could talk quite reasonably and make myself understood. Well, this sort of passed the time. And our food, well, it was very poor. We got crack wheat for breakfast. I would imagine no milk now. Nobody ever mentioned milk because there's no such thing, although our good doctor managed to get some milk into camp for some of our invalids. Then in the middle of the day, we had red beans and probably a chunk of meat, about 20 pounds, and this was to satisfy the requirements of food for 280 people. In the evening, we maybe got a little rice, and each day we got 6 ounce loaf of bread. A lot of people got parcels sent in from outside, from friends, and the Swiss consul, he saw that these came in from his office by a truck, and this augmented quite a lot of our food. I had one or two friends, so I was lucky. I had often a little tidbit, such as a piece of bacon or an old hard-boiled egg, and these were luxuries. Well, we got this town, and then about 1944, we got an American food parcel. It was just sheer delight to see it. There would be, if I remember rightly, a packet of sun-made raisins, 2 tins of butter, 2 ounces each tin, a tin of Maxwell House coffee, and inscribed on it was "good to the last drop," 4 ounces of this instant coffee. I'd never seen it before, but by it tasted good. A tin of skim milk, and then we had 2 slabs of chocolate. And I can remember well, each of these slabs was in little cubes, and on the paper covering it said that we have a very poor diet, so we must treat this chocolate very carefully and suck 1 cube, not more than 1 each day. I might say I swallowed the whole 8 ounces in 1 sitting, and I didn't suffer any trouble from my indigestion. Then there would be a little cheese, I think. Anyway, it was really manna from heaven. Well, about late 1945, we were told to pack up that we were going to go to Manchuria and that we were going to be en route to Japan. Well, this caused a stir, plenty of talk and so on. Well, the day arrived when we had to pack up, and trucks arrived, and all our stuff was taken down to the Shanghai North Station. And it was all loaded into big goods wagons by our strong arm gang. The following day, the whole camp was mobilized and lined up and into trucks. And to our surprise, before we went off, we were each handed a British Red Cross parcel. There was no cigarettes in it, but it was a real humdinger. There was bully beef, and there was some of these luncheon meats, and we had a tin of suet pudding. And we also had tea and some coffee and some biscuits and some sweets. These were these boiled sweets. And this was told was to see us on our journey to Manchuria. This was the food we were to get. So we actually fed ourselves. But I can assure you, these Red Cross parcels, American and British, were well received. And I often wonder how many parcels the Japanese swiped before we got ours. The little beasts. Well, off we popped on the train from Shanghai, and the first official stop was Nanking. And there we drew up, and the Chinese on the platform, this is the Chinese prototype, would ask the Japanese who we were in Chinese. And of course, we had a lot of good spoken Chinese scholars in our thing, and the Japanese turned around and said they were captured American airmen who had been shot down over Shanghai. What a laugh we got. Well, we came across the Pukau ferry at night, and it was quite an exciting experience, because we were all hemmed in this carriage, barbed wire all round. Japanese sentry each end of the carriage. It was a third class coach, wooden seats, three abreast with this middle alleyway, and our toilet facilities were to be seen to be believed. It was a hole at the end of the carriage. Anyway, off we went, and in 3 days we arrived in Tientsin, still hemmed in. And we were pushed through there as quickly as they could. They didn't want us to be seen. And eventually we arrived at a place called Feng Tai. It was a sort of railway junction, and we were eventually housed in a transit shed. Nice, beautiful floor of earth, hard-baked stuff. We had to walk from our station to this Feng Tai Junction about a mile. And having been on the train for over 3 days, we had great difficulty in walking. I wouldn't have believed that we were all stiffened up so badly. And our feet were swollen, and lots of us had to be helped along this road. And there we arrived at our destination, still with our remains of our food parcel for our maintenance. And we were hemmed in a barbed wire fence, and inside was this transit shed. Our toilet facilities were really not in existence. We washed outside barbed wire under guard at a standpipe. And inside, well, our toilets was a super ditch, maybe 10 feet deep by about 15, 20 feet long and 3 feet wide. And we had to squat to do our business. Well, to help our elderly men, we made a chair. So they sat on this, which was comfortable, and anybody else could sit on it if the opportunity arose. I'm telling you this just to let you know that everything the Japanese did was not done to our best comfort. Well, one night, after we'd been there, a good friend of mine, John Irvin of the Chartered Bank, had gone out to this toilet, and he didn't smoke, but had lit a cigarette out of just defense. And the Japanese sentry outside saw this glow of his cigarette, and without having permission to come in to think, he attacked John Irvin with his big belt. And it was a leather thing with a brass buckle. And of course, being in the heat of Manchuria in June, it's pretty hot. He hit him right across the bare back with this thing.
But couldn't get cold in the morning, and about 6 o'clock the whole camp was agog. Here was this Japanese sentry down, couldn't get out, and he had a very nice 2 hours sweating down there, shouting, but everybody went along, never saw him, and they just did their best to help the man with his shouts. They just did their duty on him. Well, of course, he was eventually found, and there was a devil to pay. He described his attacker, was somebody over 6 foot. So, as we only had about a dozen 6-footers in our camp, little fellows like myself, 5'7", were right out of the count. Of course, this sentry couldn't turn round and say it was somebody his own size. He had to claim that it was a great big fella. Well, everything passed off eventually, but there was some fun and games. Well, there we were, and we could hear at night lousy tune crowd. They were guerrillas who had come crouching down, and they would open up 2 or 3 rounds and disturb the Jap sentries, and they would be pushed out in the middle of the night, firing blindly into the dark at so-called enemy attacks. Oh, it was pretty worrying. We didn't know where we were going. One day we were told it was next week, and eventually a day was told it was the 19th of August. We had to go to Dairin, and from Dairin we'd get a boat which would take us to Japan for our entire rest of the war. One day, to our utter astonishment, the Japanese Formosan sentries came back from their Sunday leave, and our cookhouse was outside this barbed wire. And they told our cookhouse that the Japanese emperor had spoken to the nation and said the war had to finish, and the Japanese had to lay down their arms and no more fighting. Well, of course, we knew, and the Japanese Formosans, who didn't like the other Japanese proper, they were telling the truth. But when our camp commandant asked Odira and Honda about it, they repudiated and says, "What, just a bad story, we're going on the 19th to Japan." Well, this was a real kettle of the fish. And eventually, one day afternoon, along came a lone aeroplane, and it was an American plane, and it flew round over our camp, and there was great buzzing. And when we all put out all our clothing with shirts and so on, and a great Union Jack, and the observer on this plane must have seen us, because he circled back again and then wagged his tail gun. So we knew that we had been seen. Well, we then heard that the Japanese commandant, or the general, had refused to surrender, and that he was going to go on fighting. This was a bit of a damper to us. We were still going to Japan, heavens, but the Japanese in Tokyo sent over one of the royal household, Prince somebody or other, maybe Chichibu, I don't know, and he took the sword away from this General Terry Cooney, or whatever his name was, and that finished the fighting. About the 15th of August, a group of American planes circled over the airport, which we could see from our camp. And out of these planes, there jumped a mass of different parachutes, some yellow, some red, green, white, you name the colors, they had it. and we could see these parachutes falling down there. That was maybe 20 miles away. Well, this was great to us because we knew it wasn't Japanese planes, it must have been American planes. Well, the following day there was a great hoo-ha, and who should arrive in the camp under the Japanese escort but American officers who were sent to Peking to obtain our release from internment. There was all sorts of do's, and instead of going to Japan, it was arranged the following day that we would be taken into Peking. Well, were we happy? The tins were opened, we had a mountain of unopened British tins of food, and there we had a great feast, and left all the tins in a great mound there as a monument of our departure. We were taken into Peking by truck, and at night, because the Japanese did not want the Chinese population to see us. And we were taken to a Chinese hotel which was used by Japanese officers in Peking when they went there on their leave. The Americans' officers I regard as very brave men, because they did not know when they came out of these aeroplanes by parachute what kind of reception they would be receiving. They explained to us that all the various colored parachutes represented some type of sun. One was cigarettes, another was food parcels, which they called K-rations. This was the iron rations that the American soldiers got when they were advancing in war. So these rations were given to us to feed us in this hotel. Well, the American officer in charge, he didn't like the idea of us in this Chinese hotel. It wasn't good enough for British civilian officers and prisoners of war. And 2 days later, he arranged that one half would be housed in the Peking Hotel, a very superior place, and the other at the railway station hotel, which was known as the Wagon Lee Hotel. They apologized to us that we would have to have 2 and 3 beds in a very large bedroom. Well, it was just laughter to us when there we were lying on the floor and fainting on the mud, and we were shoulder to shoulder. So no hardship, but splendor to us and luxury to be sleeping even 2 beds in a room. Yes, yes. We were given K rations, which the American soldiers used when they were in the front line and advancing in war. Each package, one for breakfast, one for lunch, and one for dinner, to us were magnificent. And we had this for enough rations for maybe a week. We also got a packet of Chesterfield cigarettes, 20 in a pack, for one a day, as this was the American soldier's ration. Well, we were on the top of the world, and an amazing thing happened. Some representatives from the Russian consulate came over to see us and asked us if we'd had any money, we could arrange anything, that they would be very happy if we would join the Peking Club, which was a sporting place that had good restroom facilities. There was a car room, a billiard room, a swimming pool. And the reason they wanted us to do this was the Germans would get pushed out. They were in the majority in this Peking Club. Well, about 40 of us managed to rake up some funds. A friend of mine, Gabbett, got me a loan of $30 from the French bank, And I went over there and spent many happy hours. And these Russian people were very kind to us, you know. And I quite often wonder why all this hoo-ha between the politicians when these legation boys were most helpful to us in our Pekin days. The mayor of Pekin, a Chinese, was a very good gesture to us. He laid on some trucks and we went to the Summer Palace, which was some 20 miles out. This was the former Empress of China's summer residence, and there was an artificial lake there, and there was a great colonnade of walks, and there was a marble bridge called the Camelback Bridge, and the lake was man-made. It was only 2 or 3 feet deep. Well, this was a good day's outing for us. We got through the Summer Palace, and I must say the Japanese saw that no looting took place, so it was still an apple pie order. And to my amazement, there was a case there with 13 French bracket clocks standing about 15, 18 inches high. And my mother had one similar at our house in Trun. Well, I made inquiries about these clocks, and it turned out that numerous ambassadors to China bought one of these clocks from France, and they were handed to the Empress Dowager on her birthday. So one ambassador does this sort of thing, every other ambassador of note, I had to follow suit. Well, there it was. Another day, we were given the facilities to go and see the Great Wall. We went by train so far and then truck so far. It was an all-day outing, and we just got to the wall, walked along maybe 100, 200 yards, and then had to return. But I did see the Great Wall, and it was real eye-opener. Then we had the Forbidden City opened up to us, and I saw through that, and then there was this on the hill in Pekin, I forgot the name of it, there was a sort of temple up there, and in all we had a very nice time waiting in Pekin. The reason for our 6 week stay there was that the seas out of Tsin, where all the Yellow Sea was all mined, and until these mines had been cleared, the Americans couldn't get us out of North China. Well, we had a good time, and eventually the day came, and we were told that we were coming down, and we were leaving on the 4th of October. We went down by Tsin by train, and to our astonishment, on the platform, there was lined up Colonel Odira, Honda, Dogface, all the gendarmes, all things, saluting us as we left this Pekin station. What possessed them to come along to see us off and give us a general salute with their rifles? I do not know. But they got the raspberry. All they got was a long chorus of baka. And off we went. Well, Tsin, we struggled through there and got down to the 20 miles. I've forgotten the name of the mouth of the river. And there was a landing tank craft at our disposal to take us out to the transport, which was taking us back to Shanghai. Well, I carefully watched on the shore before I went onto the landing tank craft to see that my trunk and my suitcase was duly taken off that truck and put on board the American craft. Anyway, when that was on I went. And what did we get? Magnificent fresh coffee, beautiful white bread and thick butter and cheese. And did this taste good to me? Whoa. And to my utter astonishment, the American sailors who had charge of this catering asked if we wanted a second go. Well, you could just imagine there was a second go all round. And we motored by this, taken over to the boat, the Lazaka. It was a transport, and, well, 15,000 tons. And this took us down to Tsing Tau first. And we landed at the pier, but we weren't allowed ashore. And why we went into Tsing Tau, I do not know. But across this pier, on the other side, was HMS Bermuda.